5. Troops in contact. Stand by for assault. 5-0, enemy troops in the open. Grid 1-8 Zulu, Bravo Foxtrot. 0-9-1-1-2-0-0-1. No cash requested at this time. If it's available, you can send a bone. But I think we got this.
Jeffrey Armadillo, Mother Forker, and this is Mother's Brother Hour. And my guest tonight is AJ Powell. AJ, are you there, brother?
Hey, man, I'm here. How are you today?
All right, good. Doing great. Glad to have you on the show, man.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me.
Cool. All right, so AJ, there's a lot to talk about with this dude. This dude is very active. So we're going to talk about three big topics. Leadership. I know that's a big ball of wax. All our audience is probably thinking, leadership? Really? You're going to talk about leadership? But we are. And his Lessons Learned project, which you could be part of. And then some of the veterans issues that that a lot of veterans have to deal with, and how your military skill sets can help deal with those. But first, AJ, tell us about you, man. I mean, just to kind of start it off, I mean, extreme athlete, traveler, pilot, diver, mechanic, environmental compliance, Army veteran, rescue technician, researcher, and that's not even the whole list. Holy smokes, dude, when do you sleep? So tell us about you. Put all that in a coherent little story and tell us about you, man.
A story. All right. I'll do my best. So I'm a retired United States Army non-commissioned officer. I was a staff sergeant. I was a 15 Tango, 3 Foxtrot. And basically that means that I was a H-60 Blackhawk crew chief. I'm actually medically retired. I've incurred multiple injuries throughout the course of my nearly 13-year-long career, and the worst of which was my back, and so that got me some retirement and kind of forced out of the Army a little early. I spent the vast majority of my career working in aviation, where I've been extremely blessed to have worked across the vast spectrum of aviation operations. So everything from search and rescue, combat rescue, personal recovery, medevac, combat aviation, general lift, you know, we call ass and trash, VIP, DV aviation, POTUS operations, and even special operations aviation and aviation support, just to name a few. I was blessed with a highly diverse career that fortunately gave me a large variety of amazing opportunities to attend more than 20 different specialty schools and certification programs, including SAR, rescue technician, scuba, HATS, Dunker HEAT, environmental compliance, HAZMAT, HAZCOM, CRC, and a lot more. So I'm a certified instructor. I've got over 1,500 flight hours as a qualified crew member in a variety of rotary wing and fixed wing platforms. And I've even had the opportunity to work at the multinational level with NATO and allied partners. Post-retirement, after I was retired, I went back to school. I hold 2 university degrees from Penn State, including a degree in sociological field of organizational leadership, where I specialize. I'm a published researcher in the field of sociology. Like I said, I specialize in what's called inductive analysis. Personally, I've lived in 8 nations around the world so far in my lifetime. I'm a social and political advocate for the veterans community as a whole, and I have a long list of personal hobbies, which I have entirely way too little time and too little money to be able to do all of them.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. So I love traveling, experiencing new things, and meeting new people. Right now, I am still an active, current DOD, Department of Defense employee. I'm the owner of Veteran Leadership Solutions, which is a professional consulting and coaching service that provides research-based analysis to our clients so that we can teach, coach, mentor, and guide them to success. And I'm also the director of strategic communications with Mountain Up Hat Company, which is an adventure lifestyle brand apparel company.
Wow, man, you do not stay still. You're one of those guys. And when you said that you have a lot of hobbies and not enough time or money to get into them all or actually spend enough time with them, I get you on that, man. All the good hobbies are, most of the good hobbies are pretty expensive and very, they take up a lot of time and they take up a lot of money. But we do what we can do. So
yeah, absolutely.
My thing that I've always loved to do, and I did it in the military and I've done it a lot in the civilian world, is mountaineering, is climbing, both rock climbing and alpine climbing on snow and ice and all that. That's my big thing. I mean, I always liked skydiving and jumping from planes and all that, but the thing that really gets me off is climbing. But the older you get, it's just so much gear and so much time, and the older I get, it's just it's kind of harder to carve out that that time and get up those mountains. So wait a minute. Do you want to talk about leadership or lessons learned first? Did you say leadership?
You know what? Let's hit the lessons learned project while we can.
Because leadership could
take all day long.
Right. Yeah. So let's lead with the lessons learned project and then leadership, and then we'll go into that. Cool. Good idea. Okay, so tell us about your lessons learned project. What is it?
All right, so basically in a nutshell, I'll try to summarize it. I'm writing a book right now, okay? And as a person who specializes in organizational leadership, I'm writing a book. It's going to be a leadership development book. But in order to complete it, what I'm trying to do is I'm trying to get story submissions from, you know, my fellow veterans across the veterans community to include in the book. And what I want to do is I want to use those stories to analyze them and teach the next generation, basically, leadership lessons learned from all the veterans, you know, past and present today. And this is something that really I don't see anybody else as kind of doing. So that's what it is in a nutshell. That's the very basics of what it is. Now, of course, the book will be, you know, has a large variety of different uses, incorporating all these stories from actual, you know, we're talking real life accounts from actual veterans. That these accounts could be anything. They could have been untold stories of heroism. They could be, you know, funny, comical stories. They could be, you know, wow, holy shit, amazing things that just kind of happened. But anything really that taught them a valuable lesson in leadership that they, you know, took with them for the rest of their time, whether career, post-service, doesn't matter. Those stories, what I want to do is I want to hallmark them in this book and preserve them. So a lot of people can read that, you know, would be interested in reading them just to read them. But the idea is that every chapter in the book is going to be an actual veteran's real life story. And then the second half of each chapter will be an analysis on it. So think of an AAR for leadership, right? An after action review for leadership. So what happened to the story? Why did it happen? What can we take away from it? What can we use better? The purpose of it, of course, is as a leadership development book. But at the same time, it also acts as a way to preserve those things, because a lot of times, you know, veterans, we have all these things, all these amazing stories that are untold and untold accounts that never really make it out into the spotlight, that people really, you know, don't know about. And then as time goes on, they fade into existence. So this could be one of many ways that we can preserve that bit of history so that, you know, that it can stay there and the next generation can learn from those events without making the same mistakes themselves, hopefully.
That's very ambitious and very interesting. You know, I'm trying to think if I can think of any other books from past wars or past eras or past decades, and I really can't. I mean, we have, you know, the Romans wrote about, and the Greeks wrote about leadership, but they didn't really do it in the way it was from the higher level, from the, you know, from the generals and then the kings, and the, that's who the historians wrote about the most. They never talked, they never wrote about the, you know, the lower, the ranks. So, but are you aware of any such books from World War II, Vietnam, anything like that? Have you done any kind of survey to see if there's, what else is out there?
So I have done a survey, and of course I spent many years in college reading leadership book after leadership book after leadership book after leadership book. The truth is that there are very, very few works out there that accomplish all three of the goals that I'm going to be using this book, wrapping into this book the way that mine do. And those examples that do exist are either purely academic or are very limited case studies of individual accounts. So the reality is that there really are no other similar projects in the manner in which I'm trying to produce this book. In other words, this book might, I'm not saying it is, and I don't want to suggest it, but it might be the first of its kind in its own little unique way. I don't know, maybe.
So who's your intended audience? Is it just general public to buy in bookstores or whatever? I don't know how many people buy books in bookstores anymore off of Amazon or whatever, e-books, physical books, but also maybe that professors in classes or instructors in classes would select and make required reading for classes. What's the audience you're projecting?
All of the above, actually. So the purpose of the book, of course, is to be used as a leadership development book, you know, a tool that my hope is that everyone will be able to use it for their own personal and professional development. I'm hoping that after it's completed, that it'll be picked up and used by military organizations right down to individual units to large, you know, larger echelons and commands. Included, I'm hoping that it'll be included in professional reading lists, because there's a large number of professional reading lists out there, including military and non-military. Maybe even added to some curriculums, like you were suggesting. I'm hoping some universities might pick it up for one or a few of their different leadership courses, make it probably a part of the course, perhaps maybe be included in some ROTC programs. And on the civilian side, I'm really hoping that even companies will probably pick it up and include it as part of their professional development programs, or that individuals across society would even simply just enjoy picking it up and reading it just to read the stories, even if they're not interested in the analysis part of it and learning the leadership lessons. They're just interested in reading the stories from all the numbers of veterans that are included in the book. Even then, I'm hoping that would be attractive.
So you're wanting this collection, all these stories, to be tutorial and carry a lesson, thus lessons learned, but also be entertaining, be just good stories in their own right, like short stories or whatever, some of them funny, some of them scary, tense, and all that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, exactly. What I'm not looking for, and I probably should be specific about it, what I'm not looking for is for people to draft a story and then draft a lesson in the story themselves. What I'm looking for specifically is for people to just to write down their story, whatever story it is, just pick one story and write down that incident as if you were telling a tale about something that happened. For example, let me ask you something, Joe.
Right.
During your career, did you ever have like an oh shit moment that happened that taught you a lesson?
Oh, dude, all the time. And I had lots of mentors, too, who taught me a lot. And I'd have to think about it, but I still think about it all the time. You know, guys would, an event, something happened, or a guy would just tell me something, or sometimes pretty mundane, sometimes it was pretty adrenaline infused, but lots of stuff.
Okay, so without going into, you know, you describing the lesson that you learned from it, would you be able to possibly write down a short story, you know, a couple pages, and describe the event that happened that you witnessed?
Oh yeah, but I would write it down just like I was telling it at a bar to a bunch of other vets.
Exactly. So that's what I'm looking for. That right there. That's what I'm looking for. I'm looking for a large number of those of these types of things. That's what I'm looking for in submissions. When people submit a story, I want them to tell me the story in writing, in a simple Microsoft Word document, exactly as they would tell it to other people. And then once the story has been submitted, of course, I'm not going to lie. I'm going to go through all of the submissions and I'm going to pick out like the 30 or 40 best ones. And every single one of those are going to be their own individual chapter in the book, okay? And every chapter is going to be divided into two sections. The first half will be just their story as they wrote it in their own words. They will get full 100% attribution for it. They'll get full credit for it. Their names will be in the book. They're going to be an author of that story. And I'll tell you what, here's one better. I am actually going to financially compensate every person whose story makes it into the book, too. So they're all going to get financially – every person who submits a story and their story gets put into the book, they're going to get financially compensated for their story as well. And then the second half of every chapter – so the first half is their story as they wrote it, and then the second half is going to be the analysis that teaches the lesson. That's how the book is going to be laid out.
Cool. So you want solid stories. One thing I see a lot because – writing is part of my gig is people will submit stuff and it's everybody, and doctors and lawyers are the worst. And people often write stuff in a style that is pretentious and it's not conversational and engaging enough. Like you're like telling a story to a friend and they infuse all this, you know, pretentious bullshit to try and sound on a certain level to sound important. And actually, military officers are terrible about this too. Lawyers, doctors, and former military officers or active military officers, they think they have to write in a certain style and voice that actually makes for bad storytelling, that really diminishes the power of story. So are you going to be are you going to be editing, or are you going to like send back submissions and say, dude, this is a great story, but you got to write this like you're telling to a bunch of buddies and not like you're trying to impress a bunch of, you know, what you think a bunch of, you know, chancellors at Harvard would want to hear or whatever. So, you understand my question?
I understand your question. So my goal, my aim is not to edit their story in any way. I am not going to be the one to do that. It's not my story, it's theirs. I do agree with you that some people can be extremely pretentious and, you know, highly analytical about the way they write things, and that's not really great for storytelling. It doesn't really help either. So my goal and my aim is to actually work hand in hand with the original authors, the actual veterans, their story, to produce their story in a way that is powerful, motivating, inspiring. However, you know, the event is, whatever it works out, however their creative writing style ends up ultimately becoming, to produce a quality, good story for inclusion in the book. I intend to work with them on it. And then go from there, you know, after everything's complete and the process has been completed and everything's ready to go. And then from there, I'll go through the analysis section and build the book chapter by chapter by chapter.
Cool. So, you're open to, and I know you are because we talked about this earlier, all MOSs, all ratings, all branches, all ranks, no matter what, any veteran, no matter how, if they were in for 2 years or 30 years, if they think they have a good story, please go ahead and submit it. That's where you're coming from, right?
Absolutely. I do not want to discriminate in any way. I'm talking all veterans that have a no shit, there I was, come to Jesus type, reality check type moment. Doesn't matter what your branch is, what your job was, where you were at. It could have happened out at sea on a boat. It could have been downrange in combat. It could have been, you know, on a training operation. It could have been while flying. It could have been while scuba diving. It could have been at the range. It could have been at home. It doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what branch you're from or what your background was. If you have an actual story from your time in service that taught you a valuable lesson in leadership, that's what I'm looking for.
Cool. So do you have any, because you've been dealing and writing and reading about this topic for a number of years. So do you have any expectations on how many people are going to, when these kind of come to Jesus epiphany moments happen, at the younger ages and the lower ranks than the older? Because That's my assumption, because I think when we're younger and, you know, the E1 through E5s and E6s, they're immature, they're developing in terms of, you know, the younger guys and gals, the younger soldiers, sailors, Marines, airmen, whatever, they tend to be not as clued into things like leadership and other issues. So do you have any expectation on how many do these epiphanies happen at the lower ranks and the younger ages? Or I wonder if you'll get any submissions from, you know, senior NCOs and senior officers.
Well, my hope is that I'll get some submissions from, you know, the gamut of ranges, whether, you know, in ranks, jobs, and times in periods of service. However, you know, like you were alluding to, I kind of do expect that submissions will come from people more senior, or people that, let's say they only did 3 or 4 years and then they got out and moved on with life. And later down the road they finally kind of alluded to learning the lesson that they should have learned years ago. I'm kind of expecting maybe a little more of those types of people who are a little further along, maybe mid-career level or senior career level, to be interested in submitting something that probably happened from earlier in their time, you know, earlier in their career.
You know, but there's no telling, because, you know, just, oh gosh, a couple of months ago, I was told a good story. There were a bunch of us hanging out. We were all vets at this bar that a lot of us kind of hang out at. And a friend of mine, he's an SF guy, and he retired as a warrant officer, and he was telling a story about it was leadership oriented, and he had this experience when he was younger, and then before he was a warrant when he was still an NCO, and now he's a cop, and I won't go into the details of the story, and then as he's a cop and he's later on, he has an experience that relates to that previous experience that led to an aha epiphany, holy shit, there we were, now I get it kind of moment. So that, I thought that was kind of interesting. So you might get some of those too.
Yeah, what that is the correlation effect in the brain, where they're relating the incidents they just experienced with a past experience that happened maybe years and years prior. And they're correlating that knowledge, and that's what's actually creating the epiphany. And believe it or not, I just read a story. Somebody submitted to me the first submission that I've gotten so far since I made the announcements for this book. Finally came in today, and I got done reading it a couple hours ago, and it was exactly along those lines. This guy wrote very eloquently, building up to the event that happened, and all of the things that happened prior were kind of leading up to it. And then when this event happened in his life during his time in service, it kind of brought him back and reminded him of those previous events. And then, of course, he continued on with it and wrote later on in life after he'd gotten out of military, where he had encountered similar events that, of course, reminded him of those previous events as well. So I don't think that's entirely uncommon.
Mm-hmm. You know, to bring up, to tie back into with the intent of your book and the intended audience and the business audience, and one thing, and I was thinking about this, and I actually wrote about it in the pitch I made for tonight's show. When, after we talked earlier, I was thinking about World War II and how the experience of World War II transformed the American business community in terms of organizational dynamics, management, how, you know, all this, because when I got out of the Army, went to college, and then I went and I worked in the financial industry, and I remember constantly thinking, holy shit, whoever set this company up was in the military. And I brought it up once and to a guy who was like in his 50s, like, oh, yeah, it goes back to World War II. After World War II, all the vets came home, went back to work, and said, this is screwed up. We're going to set this up in squads, platoons, companies, you know, different levels, just like in the commands, you know, in the command chain of command, just like in the military, with a little adaptation to business. But anyways, World War II really did transform business organizational dynamics in the 50s, which had a big part of the transformation of business in the 50s, an explosion of prosperity in America. So I kind of wonder if there's going to be anything like that to come out of – it'd be interesting to know if there's any new dynamics to come out of the global war on terror – and if it has any impact on the business community. Do you know if it has?
I would say yes and no. And the reason is it's a multifaceted type of question when you're talking about that, because now you're actually bleeding. You're going into the leadership aspect of the conversation here. Quite honestly, this is a separation between conceptions and perceptions of leadership between military and civilian, right?
Right.
And what we can say, and in order to answer this, you kind of got to back up and look at it from the different types of styles, if you will. What we can say on the civilian side, or suggest anyway, is that civilian leadership focus has historically been primarily one centered around more democratic leadership styles. In other words, most people don't like being told what to do, so allowing
right.
them to be a part of the leadership process provides a workaround that leaders can use to motivate them into doing what needs to be done, right?
Right.
However, you got to remember that leadership as a process throughout the civilian environment also tends to follow very close association with the prevailing social environments at the time too. So
right.
during a period when most people throughout the society ascribe to more intelligent or conservative social standards and expectations, we see more examples of things like strategic leadership, transformational leadership, team leadership, cross-cultural leadership, and facilitative leadership styles that work throughout businesses, organizations, teams, ventures, and so on, and even within our government and its relationships too. So during the post-World War II era, if you will, all the people that got out had brought with them all of these more autocratic and strategic and transformational style leaderships with them, and use those in the business culture after their service was completed. So at the opposite end of the spectrum today, we have a society by and large right now in our day and age that kind of ascribes to more liberal social standards, which
okay.
actively kind of works against, it actually works against the majority of different leadership styles and processes. So civilian leadership, while historically can be generalized in the last 100 years or so, by and large, changes with the social trends and creep across our society. On the other hand, military leadership kind of doesn't do that at all. It remains relatively consistent in its base foundations, which would be autocratic leadership styles, which is the command
right.
control, the structure, the chain of command, the things like that, right? But then
right.
what you notice, if you spend a lot of time in the military, what you notice is that as you progress up the ranks, the autocratic leadership styles is more the foundation. And what we find are more examples of the vast spectrum of leadership styles incorporated into the military structure. So in reality, leadership within the military is designed to force a person to work hard from the ground up, against their will quite often, to understand leadership as a process before they begin moving on. And then it takes the individual through all four phases of learning, through the four different phases of the learning process, so that they can apply leadership in nearly any context or any situation. And this is something that effectively sets service members vastly apart from the majority of civilians. It's not to say that there aren't great solid examples of civilian leaders out there, because there are, but their numbers are far fewer an example than the typical average veteran example would be. And I think that this is going to have a large impact in the business community today, post 9/11, a decade and a half down the road, as you see the business cycle as it moves up and down through its trends, and the civilian side of leadership as it mirrors social expectations versus all these veterans that have spent a career now fighting a war coming out with a large gamut of leadership styles that they're going to incorporate into the corporate structures down the road.
Right. By the way, I want to take a break right now and just say, invite all of our listeners who are listening right now to call in if you have any questions, if you'd like to find out more. And AJ, I'm going to ask you to tell people how they can contact you and how they can submit for the Lessons Learned Project. Our call-in number is area code 646-716-8075. And from the website, from a couple different websites, you can or apps, whatever, you can text in questions too, and our producer will relay that to me. So, and also I'd like to invite you to all of our listeners out there, what is leadership to you, and what do you see the big challenges of leadership, and what do you see the differences between military leadership and civilian leadership, and what are some of the problems and the frustrations that you have run into over the years? All right, so AJ, so back to you. So tell us how people can contact you and how they can submit stories to your Lessons Learned project, and then we're going to get back to leadership.
Sure. So I can be reached across social media. You can find me on Facebook if you type in Army Veteran AJ. You can find me on Instagram at the same thing. Just type in Army Veteran AJ. You can find me on Twitter at Veteran AJ. And you can submit a story. Simply type it up, a short story, how you want to write it. Include your name, number, information, good time to contact you and reach you. So we can discuss the matter further. And put it in a simple Microsoft Word document, and you can send it to me in an instant message on Facebook or on Twitter, however you want to do it. Attach your Word document and send it in. And if you can't do that, you can always send it to me by email at vetslead@gmail.com. That's vets, as in V-E-T-S, lead, L-E-A-D, @gmail.com, and you can submit it that way.
Good. Outstanding. All right, so you were talking about how the military tends to be autocratic and how the civilian culture tends to be more, well, pretty liberal. Even people who consider themselves conservatives are pretty, their expectations are pretty liberal in terms of their workplace and their civil, and their society and how they live their lives. It always amazes me how guys get out of the military, or people get out of the military, men and women get out of the military. You get a sergeant major. I've seen so many times a special forces sergeant major or master sergeant get out of the military, and he'll grow a beard, look like a Hell's Angel, join a motorcycle club, start wearing leathers all the time, club leathers all the time, and maybe some earrings in his ear, and he's already pretty covered in tattoos already. And he'll adopt this new attitude of "don't tell me what the fuck to do," right? So it's almost like, which leads one to believe that maybe a lot of people in the military are just chomping at the bit, going along with military culture and autocratic leadership style, and just grinding their teeth at the same time. Because, Dan, do you have any insights into the fact that is half of humanity on board with one type of leadership style, and then the other half that's just not how they're wired? How does that work?
Well, from my perspective, from my standpoint, what I see primarily is that leadership really shouldn't be a set in stone type thing. Okay. It is definitely a situationally dependent, constantly evolving and ever changing process. Leadership's not, it's a science, but it's not an exact science, like medicine, for example. Okay. It's a practice. And it's something that needs to be tailored to the situation. A lot of times what we find, though, is, and even with service members, is that, the need, the feeling of wanting to belong to the group and belong to a team, belong to an organization or something bigger than themselves, can have a severe manipulative effect on how they perceive things, how they take things, how they judge things. Eventually, they become a part of the herd. So this doesn't happen in all cases, but it can happen. So when you talk about, like, how veterans get out and then they turn their back on things. I mean, that could be for any number of reasons. It could be because that's just the way they have always been, and they were just kind of dealing with it, just like you were saying, in the military this whole time. Or it could be a cross-cultural example of how they are affected by social demands and expectations placed upon them in their post-service environment. So they got out and they chose the environment, and that environment has caused them to change or to be, become someone different and move on to something different.
And also, there's a book, I wish I'd grabbed it. There's also this dynamic, this phenomenon that a lot of veterans get out and they come back to the United States and they don't recognize the United States, either because the United States has changed a lot or they have. You know what I'm talking about? And they just feel like they don't recognize the United States anymore, and so it's harder for them to function within civilian organizations, civilian social groups, things like that. And this isn't just about business. This is about non-business social groups, This is why a lot of people like to, this is why, and I'm one of these people who thinks it's good to have veteran connections, because you can to connect with veterans can be very helpful in feeling like you're not alone, because a lot of veterans hang out with veterans and connect with veterans so they can feel like, you know, to support those veteran needs, which are basically, you know, military needs. The book I was thinking about, are you familiar with the book Tribe by Sebastian Younger?
Yes, I've heard of it. I have not actually read that book, and I feel ashamed to say that.
Well, it's really short, dude. You need to get it. It's called Tribe on Homecoming and Belonging, and it's all about how all human beings have tribal needs, which gets into leadership and gets into military cohesion and all that. And a good leader is probably like a good tribal chieftain. They, like you were saying, like in SF, the good team sergeants in special forces are guys who are pretty adaptive, who can read situations. He can read his guys on that team and everybody, including the detachment commander, the captain, and adapt to their and support their different personality styles. Whereas not everybody can do that. I'm in the military, but I've seen that more actually in corporate settings, where you get managers and various leaders at different levels who just, they don't want to be bothered with trying to read people. They just want to have a very rigid autocratic style and do this or go find another job.
Right. I think what you're referring to is the fact that people become institutionalized and they become set in their ways. And so after, you know, the time in service, when they come back to the civilian world, if you will, they go through this phase of cognitive dissonance, where their perception and their misconceptions of reality have forced them into a pick or choose, whichever thing agrees with their personal outlook or, you know, agrees with their mental frame of mind and state at the time. And one of those two things is upsetting their psychological balance, right? And so that is their misperception or misconception of civilian life. So they find it extremely difficult to adapt, or they find it hard to fit in. And so, you know, you're talking about how they don't really recognize the culture anymore, or they don't recognize, you know, the thing that they were once a part of maybe a decade prior. And so what they do is they tend to go back. The cognitive dissonance forces them to, you know, pick a side, and that side that they go back to is what puts them in their happy place. And their happy place, of course, agrees with the institutionalization of the military, or what they grew used to, what they've adapted to. I mean, does that make sense?
It does. It makes perfect sense. I have a question from Terry, our producer. She says, I have a few asking where all the book will be put out.
So that's a great question. When the book is finally completed, I've already been working to line up a number of publishing houses that would intend to put the book out across bases, across internet platforms like Amazon, for example, and in several different types of stores across the United States. I even plan on trying to work, and I don't know exactly how it's going to work out, but work to try and get it overseas into different places as well. Primarily, though, of course, it'll be focused on the United States, and then internet sales will be available for overseas publication as well. But I do plan on using publishing houses to make that a reality. It's an extremely viable concept. Lots and lots and lots of people have successfully done it. It's really the best option to get it put out everywhere that you possibly can, whether it be in bookstores or on the internet.
And there's just so many different ways to put out a book anymore. It's kind of like music. Still you got to do books and bookstores, but there's e-books, and I think that actually audiobooks is kind of dying out, but a lot of publishers and writers still do that. And there's so many different websites. I mean, there's BookHub, and don't forget Amazon, and all these different, BookHub and Book Gorilla and Robin Reads and the Fussy Librarian. And oh my God, but hopefully,
right.
That's, then the publisher or the agent or whoever is supposed to be able to handle all that and take that off your hands, because if you know, that's a lot to have a handle on.
It is a lot. So I've actually received quite a bit of highly intelligent advice from a friend of mine down in San Diego who's published as well. And that was to avoid self-publishing, you know, go with a publishing house. So that is
right.
The direction I'm going to go. So self-publishing is a trap, for lack of a better way to put it. It can lead to you to financial distress. So it's not a really good way to go.
Yeah. So, but the book, so if someone is interested, they just, you know, do you have any other better way of, it's just, remember that the name of the book is Lessons Learned, and just keep searching for that. It's an easy to remember, Lessons Learned, and keep your eyes open, keep your radar active, and when it comes out, you know, just scan for it search for it every once in a while on Amazon.com, and eventually it'll be out. Do you have a better message than
that? It's going to take after all the submissions are completed, it'll take about 6 months to complete the book, and then from there, another 4 to 6 months to be completely published in print and in circulation. So right now, we're at the stage of accepting stories and story submissions. So I'm looking for as many as humanly possible. And then after that cutoff has been reached, I'm giving at least, you know, four to six months here to be safe. But after that cutoff has been reached, then you can expect within the next 6 to 8 months after that for the book to be in circulation. So sometime early next spring is what I'm guessing.
Okay, good. Okay, so
we were talking about transition, right?
Right, which is a big topic that comes up a lot on this show and pretty much any show that talks about veterans issues, transition. So what are you going to say about that, transition and leadership?
Transition and leadership. Oh, man, that's a shotgun blast, bro.
Have at it, brother.
All right. So let me stick with what I do best, and that's analyzing problems. So there is a problem in the veteran community, and stop me if I'm wrong, but a lot of people find it extremely difficult to transition for maybe lack of the ability to put their skills or a lack of the ability to find out where they kind of connect in the civilian world. You think that may be a common problem?
Oh, yeah. So translating your resume, your military resume, so it's consumable by a civilian HR department.
There you go. That's a good one. So we could pinpoint that one real quick. Translating your civilian resume. There's a guy that I know that put this in the most eloquent way possible, and I'm going to attempt to do him justice. Your career is a series of ups and downs, okay? Imagine like a wave. You know, you have high points and you have low points. What you care about and what most veterans care about and what they talk about a lot of times is that high point, that really cool thing that happened on a mission, or that really cool course that they graduated from, right? They care about the apex of these really high points in their career, and that's really what they talk about. And a lot of times what veterans do is they tend to take those high points and fill them in as bullet points in their resume. But those things are really not transferable, because that's not really what human resources departments give a shit about.
Right.
What they care about is all the things that led up to that high point and all the things that came about after that high point was over with. Okay. So let's say, for example, that you're given an op order, and the op order says you need to go take this position. Okay. That taking the position, the act of taking the position in enemy territory, that's the high point. They don't really care that you took the position. What they care about is that, okay, you got an op order and received it. You translated it and you were able to make sense of it. Okay. Then you were able to brief it. So you have good communication. Communication talking is a bullet point. You were able to, you had to build up for it. You had to sign out equipment for the operation. So that means you're responsible for things that actually have a dollar value assigned to them. And then you were able to successfully move your people from one point to another. You know, all these things that you had to do leading up to the mission, then executing the mission, okay? So your execution of it was, again, communication skills, shoot, move, and communicate, that kind of stuff. The ability to distinguish between different factors, problem-solving skills, all these things that you do and that you use, building up to that, to that point where you finally achieve the mission objective. That's what human resources departments are really looking for. Those are the things that you need to sit down and really think about, put them down on paper, and translate those into bullet points yourself. Then on the back end of that, after you got done, what did you do? Okay, so you gathered your people, so you know you have managerial skills. Then you did an AAR, you did an after action review, which is Lean Six Sigma, by the way. Those are things that civilian corporations are really big on, finding ways to discover problems and cut costs and do things better down the road. You turned in your equipment, so you're responsible, obviously. You know, you didn't break nothing, and you were able to turn it in. You have accountability for that kind of stuff. You were able to draft a report, so you can produce documentation, and you were able to brief that and prepare for the next mission. So these are all the things what civilian hiring managers look for, and what they really care about. They care about all of the skills and all of the checkpoints and all the things you did building up to and executing the operation. They don't really give a shit that you achieved the objective. That's just a notable point that you can put on there. That's a look at me attaboy is what that is. And then on the back end of it, they care about all the things you did post mission to start the cycle over and get back down to that low point and begin the next operation. Those are the things they look for. Unfortunately, the reality is that there's no set in stone translation service that can take your MOS and translate your job description into a civilian standards. That doesn't exist. What you need to do, and what I advocate all veterans to do, is to sit down, get a piece of paper, draw that wave pattern, that up and down wave pattern, and put on the top of those waves all the high points in your career. And then what you do is you write down all the things you did to build up to that high point, and then all the things you did afterwards and on the other side of the wave. And do that, and then you're going to have to, unfortunately, you're going to do a little bit, use a little bit of intelligence, use a little bit of proactive, take some initiative, get on Google, do some searching, and you're going to have to translate those terms, if you wrote them down in military terms, you have to translate those into things that, into civilian terms. So, I mean, this is going to require a little bit of work, obviously, because there's no cookie cutter methodology to it, but that's, if you can do it and you do it successfully, that's what civilian hiring managers are looking for. That's the key to everything right there.
Right. But it's learning. It's like learning a slightly different culture, but it's the same. I mean, it's not like you're learning Chinese language and Chinese culture. It's English. It's America. It's just the business culture from the military culture. So it's not that daunting. And there's other details like choosing the format of your resume. You want to start every statement with an action verb, active voice, not passive voice, and all that stuff, and try and keep it short. Less is more, because the more they have to read, if you throw a wall of text at anybody, especially if it's a resume and you're being considered for a job, they're not going to enjoy that. But you're absolutely right, man. You're absolutely right.
I think honestly there's a bunch of different formats, and there's a bunch of different things that, quote unquote business experts will tell you all across the internet. You'll find a thousand Forbes articles and a thousand HBR articles about this kind of stuff. In reality, if you can communicate in the most effective, concise way, your skills and attributes, what you did and how you did it, then you will be light years ahead of pretty much everybody else.
Exactly.
And taking the initiative to do that kind of thing is all about what you were talking about 10 minutes ago, or longer, because I ramble on, about what makes good leaders. And I think that the practice of leadership and what makes good leaders kind of makes up all of these different practices, all these things that help veterans in their post-service days as well.
Well said. Well said, man. I totally agree. So let's talk about And you and I talked about this earlier, that all veterans come out of the military with some leadership skill set, some more than others, but at least it's not an alien concept, which it is, I think, with some, I don't know how many, some civilians, because they're just never exposed, they don't play sports, they just go through life never paying attention and never being required to do any leadership. So they don't have any grasp on leadership. So, but there's other ways to develop and leverage your leadership skills. And one of those that I found with a lot of because I've been involved in this too, is extreme athletics. So I want to hear about the extreme athletics you do and what leadership advantages and expression you've seen in extreme athletics.
Okay, so quite honestly, you know, I enjoy some of the same stuff you do. Like I've enjoyed, you know, jumping out of aircraft and stuff, and climbing mountains. I'll admit I'm not a great mountain climber. I don't do it a lot, but I, you know, I'm getting more into it a little bit here and there as I've gone through a physical recovery process. Me personally, I used to do marathons, and I'm kind of building up few triathlons, and I do something called Nijmegen. Have you ever heard of Nijmegen?
Nijmegen, no. I Nijmegen drop zone on Fort Bragg, and Nijmegen, the bridge over in Holland. But I don't. Is it what's
okay.
Nijmegen?
So both of those are related. So the Nijmegen drop zone at Bragg and the bridge in Nijmegen. Nijmegen is what I'm talking about. Severe Doxy Nijmegen. It's the 4 days march that occurs in Holland in the town of Nijmegen every single year for the last 120 years. It's a 110-mile ruck march in 4 days through the hills of Holland, where military members from 40 nations around the world show up every single year to complete all 100-plus miles ruck marching in 4 days. And usually there's about a million
heard
plus.
About this. I just heard about this. Go ahead.
Oh, I was going to say, usually there's about a million plus spectators that show up, and when you complete it, if you complete it, because there's a pretty high attrition rate, the medal that you get is called the Vidox de Cruz. It's a royally sanctioned award by the royal family, and in the Army anyway, it is authorized for wear on your uniform.
Wow. So I just heard from a buddy who's going to do that this summer, because he just retired as a warrant officer, W05, and but he got one of his some European officer that he got to know over in Europe when he was at Special Operations Command in Europe called him and said, hey, you need to come do this. So he's going to do it this year, and I never heard of it. It sounds a lot to me like the Bataan Death March that they actually have in New Mexico each year, and I don't remember how many. It's 100. And something miles, or I don't remember how many miles, but it's again, it's a long march.
Right. So you're talking about the guys over in Sakhir. They like to go do it as well. So I've done it five times now. I've completed it five times now, and
You've
I won't be able to go back
five?
This year.
Wow.
Yeah, I've completed the Vidoxy Nijmegen five times now. This past year, in 2016, was the 100th year for it, and that was my fifth time, and the King of Holland was there at the finish line shaking people's hands. And so somewhere out there, there's a wonderful picture of me looking like an idiot in uniform shaking the King of the King's hand.
That's cool.
But anyways, yeah. So yeah, there is an attrition rate. It's 100 plus miles. It is in 4 days. Its average is 27 miles a day with a full, you know, with a regulation rate rucksack. A lot of people like to say, oh, that's not that hard. Okay, you do it, you try it, and then you tell me how hard it is. It'll break you off. It's literally called the walk of the world. So I do that every year. And the first year I did it to raise money for disabled veterans charities. The second year I did it, I was sponsored by the Veterans of Foreign Wars to do it with two of my best friends. I consider them brothers. I had a 2-year break because I broke my back. And then after that was after I had retired and I went through two solid years of physical therapy, then I did my third, fourth, and fifth year. I won't be able to go back this year because I'm PCSing overseas again, and I'll be right in the middle of making that move. But 2018. Myself and a bunch of friends of mine, current service members and veterans, are all planning on going to the 2018 Nijmegen, and it will be my sixth time doing this event.
Damn. That's I dig that. It's a lot of physical exertion, a lot of camaraderie, and a big party at the end. And unless you've done something like that, you just can't understand how good it feels. It's like climbing a really difficult mountain, getting at the summit and being like, we made it. Of course, then you got to get down, and that's when most injuries happen. But
now that you mentioned that, that goes exactly into what you were just talking about. When you asked me the question, like, what kind of, sayings or lessons have you learned from that?
Right.
And so for me, I like to tell people that, you know, leadership, basically, you know, we think of leadership as an application of knowledge attained as a byproduct of a never-ending, continuous, purposeful, personal and professional development of the self. So in reality,
right.
While good leadership can take the form of providing purpose, direction, and motivation to others, great leadership can be accomplished without ever speaking a word, even when
mm-hmm.
no one's around. So by taking that journey, what I'm talking about is the journey up the mountain with no summit. So I tell people that leadership development is like climbing a mountain that has no top. There's no summit to it, right? You look up at it, and it just goes on forever. Now, you know that this is the case, but you take the journey anyway, and before long, you can look back and marvel at how far you've gone. That's leadership development.
Right.
But by simply taking and honestly, you know, long distance and extreme endurance sports are just like that. Same thing with military selection courses and a lot of different types of training we encounter as military service members. The idea of never giving up, of never quitting, developing that intestinal fortitude and taking the journey anyway, despite of how hard it's going to be and how difficult the journey is going to be, doing it anyway, that's practicing leadership. And you can do it even when there's no one to lead, because by doing so, you're leading intrinsically. You're leading by example. And thus, you're able to be that motivational force for other people who see you doing it and want to join you in it.
Outstanding. Which addresses the issue of how can leadership help the individual, not just the organization, which you just very eloquently answered. Cool. So do you ever do like Spartan races or Tough Mudder or Rugged Maniac? You ever done any of those races?
I would love to. I did one that was called the Hard Charge at one time. But I would honestly love to do, you know, the Tough Mudder and Spartan races and Zatan and all those other ones. I would love to. I just don't have the money. If I had the money, you bet your butt I'd be there tomorrow. But it, you know, it's travel, it's time, it's that all kind
right.
of wraps into it. So instead,
right.
I try to focus on using the knowledge and experiences that I have to try and help other people. And then I focus on the ones that I can make it to, which, you know, like I plan Nijmegen a year out. As soon as July 30th rolls around and, you know, August 5th or so, between July 30th and August 5th, when I'm planning my return trip from Europe back to the United States, from that
right.
day forward, I'm planning for the next year's Nijmegen.
That's great. That's great, man.
It's 21 hours.
Well, we're about out of time. What would you like to leave? Is there any nuggets of wisdom or something you'd like to say about the book or just anything you would like to leave our listeners with?
Okay, two things. Well, the first thing I can say is that practicing leadership in your daily lives will not only improve you, but it'll improve everyone else around you. It's kind of like telling the world to change, right? You can't stand at the top of a mountain and scream for the world to change. The world doesn't care about you, and the world will never change about you, or never will change for you. But if you change yourself, the world will follow by consequence, and that's what leadership development is as a never-ending process. It's the never-ending, purposeful development of yourself, okay? So if you do that, then you'll find that life will be a lot easier, and the world will – you'll see the changes in the world as a consequence of doing that. The second thing is for the book, again, I am still actively seeking submissions from all veterans across the entire veteran community for the Lessons Learned book project that I'm doing right now. I would love to use your stories to preserve those stories, to preserve your legacy in written form so that they could be used to teach the next generation valuable lessons from your time in service. So if you have a story from your time in service, it doesn't matter what the story is, I encourage you to write it down in a simple Word document, couple pages, however you want to do it, and send it to me and let me know who you are, you know, your information and everything so I can contact you for it so we can see if we can include it in this book because I really want everybody to be a part of this amazing project.
Outstanding. Well said. AJ Powell, it's been a hell of a good time talking to you tonight, my brother.
Yeah, I can't thank you enough for having me on the show. I'm really blessed, man. Thanks.
Yeah, so listen, I'm going to send you a link. So post the link anywhere, send it anywhere, and it's all used, so you don't have to worry about carving it up. Anyways, AJ Powell and his Lessons Learned project. The book will be coming out sometime probably end of this year, whenever next year, whenever you can get it out. So keep looking for that. AJ, thanks for coming out tonight, and all our listeners, Everybody, thank you for listening tonight. This is Jeffrey Armadillo of Mother Forkers saying be safe, sleep well, and out here.